everybody, and welcome to another episode of React Native Radio. This week on our panel, we have Josh Justice. Josh, do you want to say hello?
Hey, how's it going?
Now, I think this is your first time on the panel. Do you want to just introduce yourself, remind people who you are and why you're famous and all that good stuff?
Sure, I got to do the regular qualification that famous is relative. So I've been doing software development for about 14 years. First 10 in back-end development, and in the last couple of years, I've been getting into native and front-end JavaScript development as well. I work at Big Nerd Ranch, where I mostly work on client projects, and then a little bit of conference and meetup speaking and things like that. I'm very excited to be here.
Awesome.
Infinite Red is a US-based consultancy specializing in React and React Native. They do mobile app and web design and development. They are deeply involved in the React and React Native open source communities, publish the React Native newsletter with 10,000 subscribers, and are involved with the React Native core development. If you have a project and need design or engineering help from an experienced team to take it all the way from concept to completion, get in touch with Infinite Red. Also, check out Chain React, the React Native conference, which is hosted by Infinite Red in July in Portland with 500 developers from all around the world. You can find them at infinite.red. Make sure to mention you heard about them in this ad.
I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. I think I introduced myself more or less a few weeks ago when I started running the show here. We have a special guest this week, and that's Florian Rival.
Hi, everyone.
And do you want to just let people know who you are and why you're famous and all that good stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure. Famous, I'm not sure if it's the right word again, but I'm a software engineer at Google. I'm working on the Android games team. So working to ensure that games are performant and running properly on Android. And I used to work at Facebook before, working on internal application, mostly using React and a bit of React Native. And even before in a company specialized in React Native applications. More generally, I'm just fond of JavaScript and gaming. So trying to do on my spare time stuff like my game engine called GDevelop that is made using React, JavaScript, and to do fun stuff with it.
Very cool. So we have you on because you gave a talk at,
was it React Amsterdam?
Yeah, I'm looking. Yeah, I think it was. But
yes, was it?
So yeah, and what I have here is basically, you know, React Native, why do we need native? And I'm a little bit curious too. I mean, in your opinion, what are the high points of using React Native as opposed to, you know, some of the other options out there?
Well, I guess that the first interesting thing is in having native I will be speaking about React Native, but that can be also React on the web or whatever your tech stack is. I just think that it's interesting to have native because you can have multiple ways of, you can have multiple needs. For example, the first thing, you can need access to the platform APIs. That's the most, I guess, most interesting stuff when you're dealing with React Native. You can need performance, for example, for games or computation or just get some predictable performance. You want to maybe some access to the device or low-level stuff, or maybe you want to reuse an existing code base. For example, in my case, I had this software, so GDevelop, my game engine, as a desktop application running on Windows, Mac OS, Linux, as a desktop application written in C++, and I wanted to port it on the web and on mobile phone. So how to do it? Well, I had to reuse this native code. So that's all the use case you can have. But something that I want to highlight is that maybe even most of the time you don't really need native. And I think that JS is, for most stuff, is really fine.
Now, Florian, in your conference talk, you kind of walked us through how your game engine started and the platform kind of fully native you were running on, and then how you switched it over and did a rewrite of a significant portion of it. Do you want to just really briefly summarize that for any listeners who haven't seen your talk yet?
Oh, sure. So the idea is that, as I mentioned just before, I have this desktop application that is written in C++. It's a game engine that allows anyone to create games. So you can picture a desktop application with a level editor in the middle and a way to create objects that you that are images that are living on the screen for your game. And behind the scene, you have events that are a way to do some visual programming. So that's the basis of my game engine. And it's something that I started like years ago, and I wanted to have it running on the web because the editor, the desktop editor, was running using C++ and using a kind of old toolkit to create interface. And I was a bit stuck with this choice. It was really slow to iterate on the software, and the result wasn't that good. It was running more or less properly on Windows and not cross-platform at all. Well, it was cross-platform, but I was running into a lot of issues on macOS and Linux. So my bet was, okay, I know about React, and I know that it is working. It is even working so well that it's working with native rendering on iOS and Android using React Native. So my idea was, okay, let's take the whole interface of the software. Let's make it again using React so that it's working on the web and maybe later on mobile phone using React Native or just as a progressive web apps. And I still need to port the whole core of the software. So the core of the software is all the tools and classes all written in C++ that describe what a game is and how to translate from a game that you created in the editor to a real game that you can play. So the game engine is outputting HTML5 games, so JavaScript games, basically. And my idea that I'm talking in the talk is let's take all the C++ code that is running this kind of business logic, if I may say so, and let's compile it to WebAssembly so that we can run it on the web. And that's for the web. If it was a native application, I would have been compiling it directly to a native library and running it under the hood, while the interface can be done using React Native. But in my case, it was using React JS.
You know, hearing about the idea of running C++ on the web has always been like magic to me. It's always kind of blown me away.
Yeah,
I'm curious, as you ported the core of your application over the C++ part, did you find that it compiled to WebAssembly pretty much perfectly on the first try, or were there major portions of it you had to rewrite to get it working in WebAssembly?
So was not on the first try for sure, right? I guess my advantage that I wrote the existing C++ code, so I more or less knew about what was easy to port or not. So I think that the main thing is that I removed all the code that was dealing with the interface and the file system. So at the end, I'm just having a code base that is doing, that is having classes that I want to expose to JavaScript and doing stuff in memory, but not so much I/O or not so much dealing with interface. So yeah, I guess there was a kind of big task of removing using ifdef, for example, in C++, removing all the code that was related to the interface. And then I think it was working more or less properly from the first try. When I first tried, it was not WebAssembly, right? It was ASM.js. So it was a few years ago using Emscripten. I'm still using Emscripten, which is a project that compiles, that is a compiler from C++ to WebAssembly or to ASM.js. It has been working more or less properly since the beginning, but I think that the most important thing is to use it right. For example, to make sure that when you're coding into a function that is creating an object, you're then releasing the object to avoid memory leaks, all this kind of stuff that you don't have to do in JavaScript, but that you have to do in C++. That's, I guess, the most difficult part.
Gotcha. Yeah, your talk had some good qualifications for those safety things that wouldn't be obvious to web developers.
Yeah. It's not that hard. It's just that it's easy to forget them. And I think that a good way maybe to deal with this is to wrap as much as possible all your calls to the WebAssembly module into a kind of bridge in JavaScript and try avoiding to leak as much as possible objects from the WebAssembly world into JavaScript, so that you are more or less sure that when you're creating something in your bridge, then you're deleting it later. Of course, it's not always possible, but that's a strategy.
Gotcha. So is your background originally in web development or in native development? Which one did you kind of start out in?
I would say I started doing native development when I was just learning how to program mostly on my own. Then I did an engineering school when I learned more stuff about it. And then web development, I learned web development later, starting with backend stuff. And I've always been a bit frustrated by web development, because when I started, it was mostly doing backend stuff in, for example, PHP. And I was like, okay, that's cool, but that's not doing, you know, real applications. These are real applications. I mean, these are not rich user interface and something that is not, it's running on a server somewhere, but I want something that is running on the client machine to make application that you can use on the go, for example. And that's when I started to look more into the front-end world and into JavaScript. And then I discovered first Angular 1. That was the first framework. I was like, okay, now we can create maybe a real application on the web. Scalable application that are robust and that we can maintain without having a huge mess at the end. Then I discovered React and React Native, and it was love at first sight.
That's awesome. Yeah, my is coming more out of web development. I was always on Macs, and so there was not a lot. All the game tools, especially, were Windows only as I was growing up and things like that. Do you have any friends that, like people you know that are coming from a web background that are wanting to get more into like native, like C++ or lower level development? And if so, how do you recommend them to get started? Because I found that something that's been challenging for me.
It's clearly changing. I'm not sure actually. But what I would recommend is maybe to take a look at lower level APIs like WebGL, because it's a good taste of native low level development for while still being on the web and enjoying all the good stuff from the web. Honestly, I'm not sure how I will start now to transition to native stuff. I guess that the next step will be to take a look at, of course, WebAssembly and trying to, start from a very simple C++ code using CMake. So CMake is the kind of webpack for C++. And using CMake, I have a very simple C++ library that you create a kind of hello world. Then you can run mscripten on it to compile it to WebAssembly and start from there. I've seen also people, I forgot their names, writing about making WebAssembly. From the ground without any compiler like mscripten. My advice is
look at WebAssembly.
Yeah, that's a hardcore stuff. I mean, it's mostly for learning, right?
Yeah. Well, I wrote actual assembly in college, and I much preferred writing C and compiling it.
I am actually, I'm not a big fan of writing low-level stuff, right? That's why I love JavaScript, because it's high-level and still you can use it everywhere.
Yeah. So is there just an extra build step then when we're talking about using mscripten or something to get it to WebAssembly, or?
Yes.
Is it pretty seamless?
There is an extra build step. In my case, what I've made is that I have basically a script file that can be a grunt file, a webpack step, or anything that's run EMCC. So that's the MScript and compiler, and generate the JavaScript library. So yeah, that's the only thing I'm not so happy with my workflow currently, in my application at least, is that when I'm doing a change in JavaScript, it's really fast. I get hot reloading, or at least I can just reload the page or open Storybook and see my changes quite immediately. While with WebAssembly, whenever I'm making a change in the C++ code, I have to remember to just run the build step. Hopefully it's not that long, but still sometimes you have to recompile everything and then you're good to take a coffee.
So is it worth the convenience to get, you know, the payoffs from WebAssembly? Because you said you don't get the hot reloading and things like that. So is it worth giving that up to go through the steps to get WebAssembly?
Depends on the use case again. In my case, it was a big win to have all the code base I had translated to WebAssembly, because I have something that is proven and working in a desktop application and used by a lot of users, now running in a browser without having to rewrite everything with the risk of rewriting something. If you're starting from scratch, maybe JavaScript is still the best way to go for making whatever you want to do. I mean, even the most hardcore business logic will be running fine in JavaScript for most stuff. Still, maybe, I mean, I've been talking about C++ because that's what I know. Maybe things like, for example, assembly script or Rust have much, or maybe Kotlin native. Well, this new language might have much better developer experience to compile to WebAssembly, so it's worth taking a look.
You know, one of the big takeaways I got from your talk was just the parallels between your applications architecture with Electron and then some native code running, and how similar that is to React Native. In my head, I've kind of pigeonholed the two as like React Native is using native UI components, so it's very native, and Electron is using, you know, the DOM for display, and so it's very dynamic. And so, but just seeing the parallels, seeing how you can drop down to a WebAssembly level, was really helpful to me. So I think React Native developers, especially those that have gotten out of native code, would really enjoy your talk and just to break out of things, to be able to think in categories, like to maybe reach for Electron more quickly than they might otherwise. I was wondering, do you think, I think most applications that are targeted at the desktop are still built on the web. Do you think there's any types of application that we'll start to see moving more towards being built on Electron that could really benefit from this lower level accessibility?
I would say hopefully not, and we can have the web platform being more and more, having more and more coverage of whatever APIs we need. For example, in my case, I'm using Electron because as a desktop game engine that need to write files, well, I have to write these files, and I don't want to have any kind of internet connection that is mandatory for users. I hope with the progressive web apps, APIs, and all this stuff going on the web platform, at some point we can maybe ditch Electron. Why not? I just also wanted to add concerning all the parallel that you made between WebAssembly Electron and React Native. I think it's something very interesting that is not new. There was Cordova before, and there are still Cordova, on mobile phone, for mobile phones. But even things like, for example, there is this game engine called Cocos2D.js, which is a kind of, React Native for games, because they embedded a JavaScript engine. It's the one from Firefox, if I'm not mistaken, SpiderMonkey, into a native app, and all the rendering is done using native technologies. So it's quite fun because I did the reverse. All the rendering is done using DOM, the DOM in Electron or in Chrome, and all the business logic is not running using JavaScript but using WebAssembly. But in my case, it was because there is no good React Native for desktop. If there was some kind of React Native for desktop that allow you to create, a user interface like you do on iOS and Android, using React from the beginning to the end and using native widgets displayed on the screen, I will go for this React Native desktop. I know that there are a few projects doing this kind of stuff, like React Native macOS or maybe React Native desktop. Anyway, but it's still not production ready, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it wasn't the DOM itself that you were looking for, but it was the React programming model, the cross-platform nature of it, and you said several times how much you like JavaScript. You know, Chuck and I were both at Chain React Conference this past week, and one of the talks was about React Native CLI and the new improvements in it. And one of the biggest things that came out of that was the idea that all platforms are now going to be first-class citizens in the CI, in the CLI. And kind of my theory is because iOS and Android were kind of baked in the past, and other platforms like React Native Windows and React Native 3D for Oculus were kind of secondary, that limited the ability of React Native to spread to other platforms, although it still was happening to some degree. But with the new CLI and having all platforms on a level playing field, I think we're going to see fewer barriers to desktop platforms having React Native built on them. And so hopefully we will see more parallels, more ability to target macOS and Linux, and to have all those platforms kind of coexist in a more supported way. So that'll be exciting to see where that goes.
I can't wait to write some Windows apps. Booyah.
Here we are, Windows apps, finally. That will be awesome. I'm a big fan of all the cross-platform approaches that we can find. Not because I love cross-platform stuff by themselves, but just because they allow you to reach out to all users. It's something that is not new again. For example, the toolkit I was using in the C++ application called WX Widgets is a way to create cross-platform interface for Linux, macOS, Windows. And it was running more or less quite properly, even if it's not maintained that much these last years. If we can have both a cross-platform framework with an approach like React, which is really good for making user interface, that's a big win, I guess, for application developers.
Now, I know in the 3D side of things, Unity obviously is very well known as a cross-platform toolkit. Have you played with Unity much at all, and to see like the things that you like or don't prefer about its programming model and things like that?
I would say it's quite different because Unity is more a game engine, which is with a really good cross-platform support, by the way. So that's again awesome. To be able to create your game and be more or less confident that it will be that it can be ported to other platforms. It's just that I think that from all the approach I've seen about creating user interface, it's the declarative and the React approach of making UI, which is your UI is a function of your state. Which is the one that I've seen, which is the most modular one. All frameworks are telling that using our framework, you can make things that are modular and extensible. That's not always true, but from what I've seen, the React or the Angular or the Vue approach of making components is the right approach for making user interface. And I really, really looking forward to see this model applied to maybe other things later. It's already the case in the latest Android Jetpack Compose toolkit, or now in Swift UI for iOS.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by TripleByte. Applying to programming jobs sucks. You have to put the right keywords in your resume, you spend hours and hours on the phone screens and take home projects, and that's assuming the company even responds to your application. Well, if you're a software engineer, TripleByte can help. They work with over 400 top tech companies, from big names like Dropbox and Adobe to exciting startups. You do one brief online interview with them, and if you do well, you go straight to final interviews with the company on their platform. It's like the Common App for software developers. TripleByte does not look at your resume or where you went to school. All they care about is if you can code. I've helped dozens of software developers with various credentials get jobs, and this looks like a terrific way for you to get in and get interviewed and get a job without a lot of the hassle and overhead. You can go check them out at triplebyte.com/reactradio. That's triplebyte.com, byte as in 8 bits. As a special offer for listeners of this show, if you take a job through TripleByte, they'll offer you a $1,000 signing bonus.
Now, you've talked a lot about the game tooling that you've worked on with GDevelop and working at Android. Now, have you developed any kind of sizable games yourself, or do you just kind of stick at the tooling kind of layer?
I did a game. It's called Lil Bub Hello Earth. I will send you the link. So I'm not sure if you know about Lil Bub. She's an internet celebrity cat. So it's not a joke. You may know about Grumpy Cat. And she's more or less also the same kind of cat, except that she's much less grumpy. There is a fun story behind this game. It's available on Android, on iOS, and also on Windows, Mac OS, Linux. And it's a kind of retro-style 8-bit game that I made using GDevelop. The story behind this game is that I have a friend who knows the owner of the cat. And we had this idea of making a game about this cat with the cat as the hero of the game. So we found someone, a graphic designer, who is really skilled in the making 8-bit style graphic assets. And we went to make this game. And we even did the Kickstarter a few years ago so that we have time and money to complete the game. So now it's out. It's made using GDevelop. And the fun thing is that it's running using JavaScript for the whole game. It's even using Electron on the desktop. And the rendering on mobile for Android and iOS, it's done using Cocos2D.js because I wanted to have native rendering. Even though if I have to start again, I would, I guess, use Cordova. And I think WebGL is now really good and able to make really competitive games.
Cool. Yeah, I'm one of those people that has always aspired to get into making games. I remember watching Clarissa Explains It All on Nickelodeon back in the day, how she would make video games of her brother. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I think that the creative hump for me has always been a challenge. Like, you know, starting with a blank sheet, it's like, okay, make a game. Like, what? I don't know if I can think of something to do. So do you, I know your website has tutorials for like getting started with GDevelop, but like helping people think about the game development process, helping people get motivated to make something small and approachable, but it's like standalone to help them make their first steps. Like, do you have any ideas for me or others who might want to kind of are having trouble getting into game development?
I guess that the first and only piece of advice I have is to ship fast, ship something, right? And at least you have something done, and that's the way you continue. I know that when I'm working on GDevelop and that I don't ship a new version regularly, I'm starting to losing confidence into what I'm doing. But to be back more on the game stuff, I think that what I try to do with GDevelop is to have concerning examples. I try to have as much examples available as possible in GDevelop because I think it's fun to just explore the examples that are bundled with the game engine. And much like when you're making an app, or trying a new library, first thing that you can do is try to an example of or a demo of the said library. I think that's a good thing to play with example to just get creative. You're not getting creative by yourself, you're getting creative by seeing other things. And the other thing too, I think, is maybe to get good assets for your game. For example, as a developer, I'm really bad at making graphics assets or even sounds or anything. And I'm always much more motivated when I get a good pack of assets that I can use. I'm starting to think about, oh yeah, I can use this to make this kind of game or so on. So there are websites with free to use assets. I know that, for example, Unity is very famous because they have this asset store where you can download or buy lots of different assets. So, get some good assets and try things with them.
Yeah, I keep toying with the idea of building a game with my kids, and then making them basically draw on paper the assets, and then have them make the sound effects like with their mouths or their hands or whatever, right? So if it's a shooting game, make them, you know, make the pew, 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 pew sound or whatever. Yeah, you know, just for fun, right? And it would just, you know, it'd be these awesome little sketch graphics that they, you know, color with crayons or something. Anyway, I don't know how easy that would be to put together, but yeah, I've always been fascinated with the idea of building games as well.
I'm pretty sure that you could try GDevelop. It's made for them, from what I can hear.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out.
So Chuck knows I'm really passionate about testing. So a few testing related things in your talk jump to mind. You talked about those core classes. You emphasized that having good test coverage for them was really important. And you had mentioned a moment ago kind of making changes to the core classes to extract the IO aspects of it from the core business logic. What did those tests look like for you of those core classes? And were they able to help give you safety as you were refactoring out the IO aspects of it?
Mm-hmm. I think that I'm pretty sure that testing Vez has once saved my life, because when I started using MScripten, I've been writing the bindings. So the bindings are, you know, the file that is used to generate the glue code between the C++ part and the JavaScript. And I started using one approach, then moved to another approach, and I rewrote all the bindings. So having this set of tests was really, for me, a way to be sure that this thing was working. More generally, I think that, for the core classes written in C++, I try to have a few unit tests for each complex feature. So unit test, or more like functional test. Just tests. For example, recently I've been rewriting the mathematical expression parser, so the thing that is looking at your formula and translating them to nodes in an AST in memory. And having tests here was more or less mandatory to write this kind of huge, complex C++ class. Then when I have it working in C++ and with a few tests showing that it's okay, I can write the few lines of bindings to expose it to JavaScript, well, to the WebAssembly world. And here I'm adding a few tests, but more to test the interface. So it's not about making sure that things are working properly. I know it's working properly because it's tested in C++ or whatever your language, Rust or assembly script is. And here it's just to say, okay, I'm making sure that the bindings, the interface of the library is properly working. It's also a good way to test that you don't have memory leak. You're making sure that you're deleting things. And that if you don't, you can create a loop and see that you're getting out of memory. And then at the end, when you have this working, you can reuse it in your interface, in your visual components in React. And that's at this point that I stop making unit tests and I go to a more like visual development approach, using things like Storybook, for example, to have stories showing my components, so that I can quickly check that they are working.
Gotcha. Yeah. Can you say more about what, like, when I think of Storybook, I think of kind of just representing a static component, you know, just showing visually what it looks like. But I'm curious if you get into any of the testing, any of the interactivity through Storybook, or if you're using any other end-to-end test tools like Cypress or something like that. Like, what does the end-to-end or acceptance testing look like for you?
Yeah. I'm not an expert on this. I think that I'm missing end-to-end test, basically. But from what I've seen, the cost of adding a story that is showing your component and that you can interact with is really, really low and provide a lot of benefits, mainly that you don't have to run your application and go to a specific screen and enter into various states of your application to check that none are crashing, for example. So for example, maybe my usage of Storybook is not really academic. In the examples that we see a button with the state that is pressed over and so on. I'm less about these visual things. And I'm more about dropping a component that can have a complex state and just as a way to make it easier for the developer. So for myself or any contributor to the software, to make easier for the developer to reach out to this component and start testing that it's working properly. And if the component is too complex, well, it's that it's being composed of other components. So you can as well expose those other components in Storybook.
That totally makes sense when you say it that way. Yeah, I've only thought of Storybook for very trivial kind of visual display components, but the idea of being able to pull up a component and interact with it, but in a way that it's pre-configured, it's set to go, you don't have to trace through a lot of complex states to your app to get there. Chuck, has Storybook or other similar kind of testing, component testing tools come up on any of the other podcasts?
Not really. I know that React Roundup has talked about, you know, some similar things, and they've talked about Storybook. But yeah, I don't know specifically if any of the other. We talked about Cypress, but you know, that's more end to end, unless you know, testing specific components.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's one of the things I'm really impressed about Storybook is just about every framework you can think of, they've got integration with it. So this could be cool to explore more in the future too.
Yeah, it's really interesting Storybook because that's, for example, something that I mentioned. I always mention it when people ask me for what's so great about making things using web technologies compared to making native interface. Using either desktop native interface or on Android iOS, is that Storybook really leveraged the way that we are making things using components, and that these components can live without their parents, and their by parents I mean the other components or even the application by itself. So that's a huge maintainability boost. Because in the long term, if you take care of adding your components to your Storybook, to your list of components, then later, if you're making, for example, an upgrade to the library that you're using to display in my case, I'm using Material UI as a basis for all my components. If I make an upgrade, I can quickly check using Storybook that everything is more or less rendering properly. It's also a huge win in terms of reaching to states that are not obvious for someone. For example, if I have a component that is exporting a game to Android, it's a component that is displaying a few steps. It's first compiling the game, then building an APK, and so on. There can be a lot of errors happening at every step of this on this process. And what I can do is to create a few stories with all the different errors that can happen and see that they are rendering properly. So I don't have to start my application and add a crash or add something to see and reproduce the state of the UI when there is an error. That's something that I've never seen before in other frameworks. And I think that's really interesting for me as a developer. And for a new developer or even someone else on the team that is not that familiar with the code base can quickly see, okay, these are all the states possible for the interface.
That's great. I've heard people talk about the idea that the component-based model that React pioneered really helps you to create decoupled user interface components. But the examples you're giving here are really fleshing that out. the idea that maybe using more classic native development environments, maybe user interface pieces aren't as reusable. And I think using Storybook and then also using kind of like example-based tests, like frameworks like React Native Testing Library or React Testing Library for the web that lets you just mount a component and pass whatever props that you want, those are two easy ways to reuse your components. And you know, folks have said about unit testing in the past that it's already one kind of reuse. So if you want to create reusable code, you use it in your application and you use it in your test. And that those tests are already going to be a design pressure to make sure that your component is, your code is decoupled and reusable. And so it's just occurring to me now that if you're using like React Testing Library, also Storybook, that's two ways your component is being reused and two ways to ensure that the design of it, that it works really independently, that there aren't like implicit dependencies that are going to get you into trouble in the future. So this is going to be really excited to try out Storybook a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. And one last thing about it is that it's in a way, it's the same thing as the classical test for any kind of programming. Try to reduce the number of dependency and so on. What I like with the components approach is that apart from things like context, like the React context, given some props, your component is encapsulated, and given some props, you know that it will be rendering properly. That's a huge, I think, a huge improvement over non-component approach, where you never show that things will be working because you don't have a list of the dependency in a way of your visual widget. Using components, you know that I have these props, maybe some context, but apart from that, that's all I need.
Yeah, that's already extremely useful just for the kind of information systems that I tend to build. So for something even more complex like a game development engine, if you're saying that in that context that it gives you good predictability, then that gives me more confidence that it'll keep working, that model will keep working my needs as well, you know?
The fun thing is that I try to avoid as much context as possible. I know that sometimes people are complaining, or when I'm working with people on UI, they're complaining like, oh yeah, we have to do prop drilling. You know, we have to pass a prop here and again here and again here, and we have to modify lots of components to pass this new prop to a component that is deep down the state, the tree of components in our application. But I think that's something that is not that bad. It's actually a good thing that if you want to get something new deep down the tree of your components, then you have to think about, okay, so I have to pass it to a bunch of components. They have to be aware of this new thing that I'm passing to them. Does that make sense? Maybe you can use a context for things like, for example, the user profile. But even this, you're creating a new dependency of your components on a user. Is it something that is normal? Maybe you should just be passing the name of the user, or on the contrary, the whole authentication context. Well, it depends, but I really love the fact that using React, you have to pass props everywhere. That's the best thing.
Yeah, it's not always bad when something is a little bit painful when you're making a change to your application. Sometimes yes. That's a design pressure that lets you know that the things are kind of getting coupled. And if it forces you to kind of ask a question and to see if there's another way to do it, that can be a really good thing.
Yeah, it's explicitness over having global implicit things.
All right. Well, I've got to jump off for another call, so I'm going to push us toward picks. Before we do that, though, Florian, how do people find you online? I'm assuming Twitter, GitHub.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Florian Arrival, on GitHub, and just go to my website, FlorianArrival.com. You'll find my Twitter, GitHub, and make sure to check out GDevelop. I'm always on the GitHub, so yeah, feel free to go also on the forum and drop a message.
Awesome. All right, well, let's do some picks. Now, Josh, it sounds like you've listened to some of the other shows, so you get what picks are. Do you want to start us off?
Sure thing. I have two picks for this week. One of them is another announcement from the Chain React conference just a few days ago. So Facebook announced Hermes, a new JavaScript engine that's going to be used. Yeah, it's going to be used for running React Native apps on Android. It has a lot of parallels with what we've been talking about today as far as native performance. One of the interesting things that it does is that when you're using Hermes for your Android React Native apps, your code is actually compiled to a bytecode. So a lot of the time savings is that JavaScript is not being parsed and interpreted on the device that you have bytecode that you're working with. Another thing for someone like me that hasn't gotten as much into the depths of implementation like that is, building a JavaScript engine is a huge thing to the point that some folks on Twitter were saying, well, did Facebook really need to do this? This is pretty excessive. But Dan Abramov had a great point in response to that, that if anybody had any remaining questions about Facebook's level of commitment to React Native, if you're going to build a JavaScript engine from scratch that's just for React Native, that's a pretty good level of commitment. So I don't think React Native is going anywhere anytime soon. So that's really exciting to see where the Hermes engine goes. The other pick I had is for an ergonomic keyboard. I started having some wrist pain recently, and I think it's just from years and years of doing a lot of typing. So some friends recommended the Kinesis Freestyle 2, and I'll share a link in the notes, of course. It's been really great. That version, if you have a Mac that has a Mac-specific keyboard layout, there's a version that has a long cable in between the two pieces and one that has a short one, but just the short one is fine for me. I can adjust it, in all three axes of movement, kind of however is most comfortable for me. And I found that it's made a big difference in wrist strain and kind of wrist pain. So if you're feeling any kind of wrist strain, don't put it off. Get it checked out at a doctor and start getting some things to help with that, because you don't want to kind of exacerbate and get really kind of long-term wrist damage as a result of it. So those are my picks.
Yeah, I just want to back you up on that. I had the same problem a while ago. My hands were actually going numb. And then I had some wrist pain as well. And I went to the doctor and they gave me some exercises to do and some wrist braces, and it fixed it up. So, just be aware that, stay on top of that. It's much easier to head off at the pass once you feel like you're having a problem than it is down the line. My dad had some pretty severe RSI issues. RSI is repetitive stress injury. And, so you're making the same movement over and over and over again. He was a dentist and he was, so he would do the same kind of motion to, clean people's mouths out and things like that. And he developed some issues that he didn't get taken care of. And he started to have some severe numbness in his hands. So, it can get pretty bad. So yeah, definitely get it checked out. I really enjoyed the Chain React. I'm pretty new to React Native. I've mentioned that on the show a couple of times. One of the things that I'm kind of playing with, I've decided that since I'm going to be on this show for at least the next while, I need to work on a React Native app. But if I'm going to do that, I'm going to build one that I actually need. And so I've been looking at building one for devchat.tv. And I talked to the folks over at Infinite Red, who's the company that put on Chain React. And they told me to go find a template. Basically an app that's already been built that looks similar to what I want, and then just modify it, because my app and my budget were just a little bit low for what they typically will engage on. And really, really like that idea. So I'm going to be playing with a kind of a pre-built app and making it do what I want. So anyway, I'm just going to shout out about that. I went to CodeCanyon.net. And picked up a template for like $100. And that'll get me started, because it has all the layouts and design and stuff. Like, I can figure out the core logic and connecting to backends and crap like that, but making it pretty, not exactly my bag of tricks. So if I have something to start from, that really helps. And so that's what I did. I went and picked that up, and I'm pretty happy fiddling with that. Florian, what are your picks?
Yeah, I think I will go with three open source projects that we already mentioned, but I think that these are things that allow you to be fast. And the first one is Storybook. We talk about it a lot, but I think that's a real change in the way you develop. So make sure to check it out and to maybe, support developers by helping them, PRs, donation, whatever. The second open source project is Material UI. There are a lot of other different toolkits for making for having already made components to use, for example, Blueprint or what else? I forgot the name of the other. So, but yeah, I've been using Material UI. It's a really great work. There are tons of components. They are high quality. It's entirely open source. So make sure to, again, support the developer if you're using it. And the last project, it's called T-Develop. It's a game engine. Make sure to check it out.
Nice.
It's a shameless advertisement. Sorry.
It's all good. I mean, if you're working on something cool, tell us about it. I'm all for that. So. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up. Thanks for coming, Florian.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome to the show, Josh.
Glad to be here.
All right, folks. We're going to go ahead and call this a wrap, and we'll be back next week.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.